Mr. Brogan.
Good morning. I'm Joseph Brogan, counsel for the applicant in this case. I'd like to continue with the testimony of Mr. Jeff Hoffman. Would you like to swear Mr. Hoffman?
No, he's under oath.
Okay. So we'll simply continue with the testimony. Good morning, Mr. Hoffman.
Morning.
Mr. Hoffman, earlier in your testimony, you outlined for us your opinion regarding trends in the healthcare market and patient needs as they relate to the specific specialties provided by Swedish Cherry Hill. I'd like to now turn to the topic of specific benchmarks or space needs used by Ms. Terry Martin and ask you, in light of your experience analyzing the needs of other institutions, whether the assumptions and conclusions contained in the MIMP were reasonable.
When we look at the overall space needs for the total MIMP, I'm gonna say that they're a reasonable estimate overall. When we look at it by component parts, some are higher, some are lower from our benchmarks. So let me just start with the hospital. The hospital was planned based at 3,500 square feet per bed. In a typical community hospital, these can range from 2,200 square feet per bed to 4,500 square feet per bed for specialty hospitals. If this was planned as a general community hospital, 3,500 square feet per bed would be quite high. But this is not. This is being planned as a neuropsychiatric cardiovascular thoracic institute. It's a very specialized hospital. From our perspective, and having planned many of these hospitals, they range from 3,000 to 4,500 square feet per bed. I think the other thing you have to take into account, when we looked at some of the trends that I talked about, many of the cardiovascular trends showed a really dramatic shift from the inpatient to the outpatient of delivering these services, but we're still using a metric per bed. So mathematically, we're building this outpatient space for very complex patients, TAVR patients, very complex spine patients that we'll have, and you heard testimony about the oncology patients that are done in an outpatient. These are still very big spaces, very big rooms, so it pushes for specialty hospitals the need per bed to the higher range. So 3,500 square feet per bed, it's actually on the lower side of a specialty hospital. When you look at Children's Hospital in Seattle at 3,500 square feet per bed, UCSF Mission Bay, which is a children's women's hospital at 3,000. When you look at Children's Chicago, which we actually helped Chris Allman help plan and activate, it's 4,000 square feet per bed. And you look at even Swedish Issaquah, which is basically a general community hospital, I believe that was close to 3,000. Well, why was that? It's because there's so much outpatient space built into that, even that community hospital. So one of the things we are seeing in our planning work across the country is the per-bed metrics starting to go up, even for other hospitals. So it doesn't surprise us that for a neuro-institute cardiothoracic hospital that the 3,500 square feet per bed. So we think it's reasonable. The other thing I wanted to just address is one of the public testimonies yesterday talked about, and she asked a very good question, which was, why are the beds, why are certain beds being higher? And I think it was a question about, are some people getting, luxury accommodations and others not? No. What they're doing and they're planning is every bed is being built as a single occupancy bed. So every person, no matter who enters the hospital, will have a single occupancy bed. The other issue is they're planning a higher percent of critical care beds. And because you're in a specialty hospital, we will plan these beds at a higher square footage for the room, the actual bedroom that the patient will be in, because of the critical nature of the patients. More equipment is needed in those rooms. There are 24/7 hospitalists, nurses that will work on this floor, in addition to the attending physicians, so there'll be more people. And lastly, the standard of care for patients is that the family can room in with the patient. So we're adding space today in a contemporary environment for families to room in. That's why the bed size in the room. The other thing I just want to say is clarifying here, anything that I talk about a square foot is going to be what we refer to as building gross square feet, meaning we're not just talking about the square foot for a bedroom. we're talking about a gross square footage that accommodates the electrical, mechanical, the hallways, all the support space, all the outpatient space as well. That's where the metrics come from. On the physician clinic space that was planned at 2,200 square feet per physician, we would say that's probably on the high side. That looks to us to be on the high side of planning, that you would plan that much square footage for physician clinics and space. We typically would see for a complex facility more like 1,500 to 1,800 square feet per MD. Though given that the bed planning range is on the moderate side, and the majority of the additional space that I'll talk about is within our benchmarks, and we consider the total space being considered as it is, it's in our opinion it's reasonable given this very early stage of planning. When we talk about education rooms, they were looking at 230 square feet per what is referred to as daily class attendees, and looking at between 800 and 1,100 people attending class at this. Now, this is more than just the Swedish Institutes. This is the Swedish Health System at First Hill and others using this facility, classrooms, auditorium space, simulation labs that will be using this space. That's probably on the high side of number of people. And if you look at an average of 650 people a day, again, every day the auditorium won't be full. Every day the simulation labs won't be full. It's a reasonable space allocation when the total is 150,000 square feet, which is an increment of 77,000 more square feet than they have today. It's not unreasonable to consider as they develop these institutes that they would require, and the fact that they use this for the broader health system, not just for Swedish or Swedish Cherry Hill. The hotel square footage is looking at 80 hotel rooms and looking at a building gross suite of 1,000 square feet per room. Wouldn't we all love 1,000 square feet in a hotel room? But when what we're really looking at here is rooms for families, and when you consider the complex nature of the patients, particularly for outpatient testing, and the co-location of services. Patients will be there for multiple days having testing and consultations from the immigration. So these would be all planned at handicapped accessible hotel rooms. A lot of them might have kitchenettes and things in them. So to use a 1,000 square foot per room, again, we think is actually a pretty conservative estimate on the space. When you look at the skilled nursing facility at 1,500 square feet, our benchmark would be 1,000 to 1,500 square feet per bed for a nursing home, and this is for skilled nursing beds and the rehab beds that they use at the facility. Again, these skilled nursing facilities aren't skilled nurse, is not going to be used as a skilled nursing facility, from what I understand and I can review, that somebody goes just because they can't stay at home anymore. These are people who are, because of the bed limits at the facility, they will use these beds to discharge people from the bed, the acute critical beds, that still need care that can't go home or that aren't ready for rehab yet, that might need two or three more weeks of healing before they can actually go into their rehab capability. And so what we a lot of times see is that organizations that develop these critical facilities want a real step down 24-hour nursing care for more critical patients so they can that don't need the acute side but need more than a general nursing home can provide, and they want to have sort of a pre-placement before they're ready for rehab because they don't want to send people to rehab too early. So 1,500 square feet per bed, while it's on the higher end of our range, it's not a typical skilled nursing facility in the community, and so we think, again, it's a reasonable estimate of what they may need, and that was our thinking on the each individual component parts.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. I want to switch gears just a bit. We've heard several comments through the public testimony about the presence of neuroscience programs at other hospitals in the Seattle area, namely University of Washington and Harborview. Do you believe it is wise or appropriate to focus on meeting this region's healthcare needs at one institution?
No. First, I don't believe one institution could meet all the future, the current and the future needs that are developing. Most urban areas have two to three centers that are developing to meet these needs. And in fact, when this has been tried before in different communities, while some might suggest that we should plan and just have one for the most critical quaternary services, we've seen that tried before. And a great example is UCSF and Stanford Healthcare in the Bay Area. 15 years ago, they merged. They actually had the strategy that we're going to be the only institutions that provide the most complex care in the entire 8 million population be Bay Area region. It was a complete abject failure. And they split, and it cost particularly UCSF, the University of California, San Francisco, a decade to get themselves back really where they were. The payer community rejected it because it didn't offer any choice for contracting for these very complex services. The public rejected it. They wanted choice. And in reality, the faculty rejected it. Both of them lost many good faculty members because of that experiment, because many of the faculty, particularly on a research basis, you don't want one research theme projected. You know, some researchers are going to say A is the answer, and some researchers are going to say B is the answer. And the fact that you have researchers competing and developing different avenues of research and protocols, there were faculty members at the highest level of complexity as these organizations say, we're going to develop one way to deliver this care, the right way. Well, in the medical community, there was an agreement. There were some very talented expertise that said, this is the way to handle certain disease. And there were others that say, this is the way. And so they had problems, and they lost people. So I think at this very level of tertiary quaternary care, most urban areas are developing two, depending on their size, two to three avenues of the most complex care. I would at least suggest to you, why would you want that? Why would you want to be dependent on one sole organization to provide the highest level of quaternary care with no choice for the payers, no choice for the community members? And the other thing that I saw in some of the public testimony that I sat yesterday, and we see this frequently in different communities, people in the community have a love for certain organizations and they have an affinity to them. And this is what drives choice. And that's what our entire health system is based on.
I'd like to delve just a little bit deeper on this question. How would you distinguish, if at all, the mission of Swedish, Cherry Hill, Harborview, and the University of Washington, and both their mission and their primary focus in the areas of care associated with neuroscience and heart and vascular?
I spend a reasonable part of my time working with speaking of academic medical centers as well as community. They all basically, Swedish Cherry Hill and Swedish as a health system and UW have at the surface level the same tripart mission. They serve, educate, to do research, and to do clinical care. But in reality, particularly in a public university setting, the driving missions, I would argue, are research and education and to educate the public. They do clinical care to support education and research. It's a critical component of education. And when you look at academic medical centers, and UW is no different, if you looked at the data, I would suggest you'd probably see several hundred million, $200+ million being shifted from the clinical enterprise, the profits, to cover the research and the education components that NIH grants and that the government doesn't pay for medical schools and for graduate medical education. So they're driving in a lot of these is at education and research, and they do clinical care as well. But when you look at organizations like Swedish, the Mayo Clinic, they have $250 million of NIH grants, but the driving focus of the Mayo Clinic is clinical care. They do education and research, but clinical care is their focus. And at Swedish, I would say, while they talk about they're going to do more research, and they will, and they're going to do, they do education, and they do, the driving focus is delivering clinical care to the community. And when you look at the profits that Providence Swedish developed, 100% of those profits are invested back in to the redevelopment of their clinical enterprise, not being shifted to, or in large part, to research education, though they will shift some in the future. And an organization like Providence, which probably has $500 million a year in depreciation, they have a capital spend plan that's probably in $500 million a year. Over 10 years, they're going to probably spend $5 billion in capital. But that's to deliver clinical care and recruit faculty. That's the difference in mission. They all have basically the same, but how they actually actualize their missions is quite different.
Okay. And Mr. Hoffman, we heard testimony offering numbers associated with the what's referred to as NIH grants as between the University of Washington and the Swedish Neuroscience Institute. Could you first explain what NIH grants are and what your response is to the numbers that were offered by that witness?
NIH grants stands for the National Institutes of Health, and they issue billions of dollars worth of dollars every year to academic and research institutions to do research. Academic medical institutions are a significantly large part of who receives those grants. I think the number was 200 million. That's really off. The number for University of Washington is probably closer to 400 million. It's huge. But when you look at heart, you have to look at, is it the medical school doing it? Is it the clinical enterprise, the hospitals doing it? If you put it all together, I think the witness talked about 200 million. I think University of Washington is closer to 350 or more million. But it just goes to speak the large research enterprise that they have. Most academic medical centers survive mainly on NIH grants. Private organizations like Providence Swedish and the Swedish Institutes will derive most of their research as they develop and continue to develop their research function from private philanthropy. And we're starting to see private philanthropy become a much bigger part. If you look just down south of us here at OHSU, they just got a billion-dollar private cancer grant that isn't an NIH grant, yet OHSU only has 200 million grants. So NIH grants are extremely important. They're complex to look at. The other issue I think you have to focus on when you compare UW to a developing neurosciences, the Cardiac Institute, is that $250 or $350 million NIH grants, that's for the entire university. It's entire for the medical school and the clinical enterprise. It's not just for cardiac and neurosciences. So I would totally expect it to be much larger. And even if you looked at UW's neurosciences and cardiovascular grants, they're going to be higher than Swedish's neuro. It's just because they're an academic enterprise, their focus, they have a strong focus on research and education. And the grants, help fund also their education component. So they're mixing all this funding to develop their missions.
Okay, thank you. And then finally, one other question with respect to some of the information that was offered during public testimony. There was some testimony associated with what is the appropriate planning horizon for a medical institution as it looks forward in terms of forecasting need. In your experience, what is the appropriate planning horizon for a healthcare institution master plan effort?
I would revise your question. What's the planning horizon that I would like versus what is realistic? It is unrealistic to be able to plan in a medical community on a 5 to 7 year planning. And the reason is that when you look at the MIMF and the plan, these buildings will cost billions of dollars. There is no way that we can justify to the market, which has to fund these buildings and these developments for our care, on a 5 to 7 year cycle. It's unrealistic. So what we have to do, these buildings that are built, we will plan them and the organization will build them to have a 30 to 40 year life cycle. Now, I would agree. Do I know what the future in healthcare looks like in 25 years? I do not. None of us do. But we have to have a planning cycle to give our best estimate based on our experience, based on the experience of the past, of what we will need today, 5 years, 10 years, 25 years. These buildings, the only way that they're affordable, the equipment and facilities, that we have to depreciate them over 25 to 30 years. And we will estimate they will have a useful life of 40 years. So part of the planning gets back to that as well. We will build flexibility into the building. In other words, how many boxes do they need for big types of equipment like MRI and cardiac cath? even though in 15 years they may change that cardiac cath equipment out to be something totally different that the scientists and people discover that they need to use. So, you know, these buildings, given their cost today, the life cycle has to be taken into account in planning. The stock market, others would just reject, and no bondholders would lend anybody money if you had to pay for these buildings in 7 years. It's unrealistic.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Hoffman, you explained earlier in your testimony Swedish Cherry Hill's function as a specialty hospital providing focused care in the areas of neuroscience, spine, and heart and vascular. What is your opinion regarding the need to co-locate the various functions described in the master plan on the Cherry Hill campus?
It is my opinion, my professional opinion of working these areas, is absolutely critical. You cannot develop high complex care facilities today without co-location. There are multiple reasons. And the first and most important reason, it's for the patient, is that to assume that in these complex diagnostic issues that patients are experiencing with neuroscience and cardiovascular disease, that we're going to send them to one organization for one thing, to another organization to the other thing, is poor care at best. But it's actually what happens a lot of times in the country today. The ability to co-locate the not only the facility, the equipment, and the expertise will benefit the patients. The other issue is, as these buildings become more expensive, $2,000 a square foot or more, and this equipment that will probably have to change out every 5 to 7 years so it can keep contemporary, to make that even sustainable is we have to get a level of throughput of patients through that equipment. Community hospitals just aren't able to do that today with small numbers. And so co-locating allows us to do that. The other thing that was talked about by several of the doctors, I'm not sure came out enough, was particularly at these complex centers for cardiac valve replacement, TAVR, transaortic, valve replacements, some of the spinal work that is being done, the exoskeleton work that Mr. Constantino talked about, requires multiple specialists to do. In other words, they have to weigh in, and in sometimes, like in TAVR, they both have to be there at the same time when it's actually occurring. And that's part of the transition to the outpatient environment. That's an outpatient procedure. And these patients that couldn't survive an open heart bypass and now can have these TAVR procedures, they're sicker, and so they have to have more specialists, more backup capability, and they require multiple specialists that day within the room. There's no teletechnology. There's no internet that can change that. That's what it is. The other example I would give you is these people get more complex than some of the neuro. I would even give you a personal example. My mother, who's an 81-year-old Parkinson's survivor, winters in Palm Springs with my 85-year-old father. She had an incident this year. They have great community hospitals in the desert. It was a mess. They couldn't solve it. Their solution was to admit her for a week, trying to get the neuro and the other consults done. She lives in Rochester with the Mayo Clinic, which is a co-located multi-specialty group practice. We were able, through some medication, to get her home. Within 2.5 days, three different specialists had done an evaluation. She'd had her tests, and by the third day, they were solving her problem. That's what co-location does, and it's critical if you're going to do this kind of care. So the other last part of co-location is for the training. As we talked about neurologists and neurosurgeons, there are estimates that we could be 20% short of these people in the next 20 years. And as this very complex and new type of care is discovered, co-location provides the ability to teach these people in a more efficient setting over the 7 to 9 years that some of these people to train. I would also add that in today's education environment, when you look at UW and any other university, the way education is paid for at a graduate medical level, most of the universities, we call them slots, and the slots are filled, meaning the government pays so much to provide for that graduate medical education. So for them to add more slots, which they will do and are doing, they have to pay and cover the cost of that because the government is not. But when new organizations, private organizations like Swedish, Cedars in L.A., step up and say, we're going to start graduate medical education for neurologists, they can apply to get paid for slots by the federal government. So that's, I'm going to assume, how Swedish will start building their education platform. And that's what our industry is expecting in the future, to help pay for the needed education that I believe will require. So that's the issue of co-location, I believe.
So last question for Mr. Hoffman. So, Mr. Hoffman, can you summarize? I know there's a lot of information that you conveyed through your testimony, but could you take a shot at summarizing your opinion with regard to your peer review of the institution's projected need in the master plan?
I'll try to be succinct. In three component parts, disease. First, I believe the incidence of cardiac and neurology disease is increasing along with the increase in aging of our population. The results will be in absolute number of people, significantly more people will present with the disease and need treatment. The plan is accurate and reasonable in its focus on these disease elements and the growth and the aging of the population and their impact on the future health care needs of the region. There will be a significant increase in the absolute number of people who will present here and elsewhere for the treatment. The plan. The master plan, as I reviewed, is a reasonable forecast of what we required in terms of number of inpatient beds, ambulatory diagnostic treatment spaces, physician space, education, research, and other space to continue to build the integrated Swedish Neurosciences and Cardiac Institute. We were asked to look at the assumptions that went into the plan. They're reasonable assumptions. They're not unreasonable assumptions. And in many cases, particularly on some of the space assumptions, there were components where they were very, very conservative, and there were some that were high. But when we look at the total space for the plan of 2.5 million versus 3 million square feet, reality is probably somewhere in the middle. It's a reasonable estimate. And co-location is the last point that I would just comment. In regards to co-location, I think I just said it, in my professional opinion, is incredibly important and highly reasonable that they expect to co-locate this highly complex diagnostic, treatment, research, and training on a single campus. In my opinion, given patient needs, cost issues, and the scientific needs that they're discussing, is really the only patient-focused and sustainable way to develop this capability.
Can I just interrupt you for 1 second, Mr. Hoffman? You referred in your testimony to a range of 2.5 million to 3.1 million. Alternative 12, my understanding, is 2.75 million. Were you intending to span between
2.7 to 3.1?
Thank you.
Was what I was referring to, is what I was remembering off the top of my head.
Thank you. Please continue.
And as far as co-location, as this is one of the major institutes in the Pacific Northwest, we need these institutes to continue to treat our population's rapidly aging demographic, and we need to remember that the first, as the graphic that you submitted from me, the top three leading causes of mortality for our U.S. citizens are heart disease, stroke, and cancer.
I'm sorry to interrupt you again, Mr. Hoffman. Just to clarify, the illustrative exhibit you're referring to, is it this exhibit?
Everything else in our mortality of what we die from pales in comparison when you look at stroke, heart disease, and cancer. And the fact that they're focusing these institutes on the neurosciences, stroke, and cardiothoracic services is an important way to treat the first and third leading cause of death in the United States. So if we're going to make an impact on these diseases, institutes such as this are critically important for us. And I would believe would be important to the people of Seattle and the state of Washington.
And thank you, Mr. Hoffman. Examiner Taylor, before we you open this up for questions, so the issue of we discussed briefly at the beginning of the hearing whether Mr. Hoffman's testimony was in fact being offered as expert testimony. You suggested that in fact you understood that to be the case. And I just want to then move for the record to designate Mr. Hoffman as an expert based on his background, just for clarification purposes.
He's accepted as an expert. And although we, Mr. McCullough, did you have any questions?
I have no questions.
Ms. Haynes? Okay. Although we got started late, this is a good time to take a break for several reasons. You need to make phone calls to your witnesses. Ms. Newman, it gives you a little bit more time to look over the material and ask questions. And so we will do that, and we'll come back at 10:30 and be ready for cross-examination.
Thank you.
Thank you.